Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all to the Worldview Lecture Series. My name is Mark Sullivan. I'm a faculty member in the College of Music, and I'm co-director of one of the sponsors of this talk. It's called the Creativity Initiative. And before bringing out the person who will introduce our speaker, I'd just like to thank other people who have supported this talk, including the Wharton Center and all their staff, Mr. Miller, Brian Zhao, and Stephanie, and other people who have been working behind the scenes to make this happen, and also the formal sponsors, the College of Social Science, the Honors College, the National Collaborative for the Study of University Engagement, and the Office of Outreach and Engagement, and as I said, the Creativity Initiative. The person who's going to introduce our main speaker, Norman Ablis, is a professor emeritus in the Department of Psychology. He's also a former president of the American Psychological Association and has received all kinds of awards. He was the director of the Psychological Clinic and director of clinical training at MSU for quite a long time and has known our speaker's work for quite a while. So I think without any further ado, I'll introduce Norman Ablis. Thank you very much.
Good evening. I'm very delighted to be here to introduce our speaker. Dr. Sternberg is an American psychologist and former president of the American Psychological Association. He's currently provost at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, and Stillwater runs deep. They have a very good football team, and they might be the national champions, but that's for a different day and different time. Dr. Sternberg has done extensive research on human intelligence and creativity, and has led to a triarchic, a threefold theory of intelligence, and also a triangular theory of love. And I don't think he's going to be talking about that tonight, but he may talk about that tomorrow. In his most recent book, Wisdom, Intelligence, and Creativity Synthesized, Sternberg argues that any serious understanding of intelligence must go beyond the standard paper and pencil tests. A theory of intelligence must take account of people's creative abilities, their ability to go beyond given information, and imagine new and exciting ways of reformulating old problems. His talk this evening is titled Creativity as a Decision. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here tonight. My first trip to Michigan was in 1975. It was the very first professional talk I ever gave, and it was for a job interview. It was not at this university. It was at another university in the state of Michigan. I'm not going to say which university it was at. It was somewhere, I don't remember even the name of the town. It was like, I don't know, Anne Boleyn or Anne Hathaway, Anne of Green Gables, something like that. And I thought the talk was, I mean, to be modest, I thought it was marvelous. It was deep, it was profound, it was entertaining, it was just a scintillating talk. Apparently they didn't think so because they didn't hire me. And the result was that I spent the next 30 years living near New Haven and teaching at Yale. But as a result of that, obviously my name was blackened in the state of Michigan for the past 36 years. And so I'm looking at this as my chance to redeem myself. This is not a job talk. And if this doesn't go well, I'm planning to come back in the year 2047 and try for a third time. And if I can't do it at the age of 97, I quit. Okay, so that's my background. And to start, there was a principal in a middle school, and she had a problem. And the problem was that the girls in her school were just starting to use lipstick. And when they would want to put lipstick on, they would go to the girls' room and they would put the lipstick on their lips, and then they would press their lips against the mirror like this in order to smooth the lipstick on their lips. And after they'd been doing that for a while, the principal realized that she had a problem because the mirror was constantly full of lip prints. So what she did is she identified the culprits, brought them to the girls' room, and told them, look, you can't keep putting lip prints on the mirror because it makes the mirror very dirty, and moreover, it's a lot of work for the custodian to clean it up. And if you don't believe me, I'm going to have the custodian come in here, and he's going to show you how much work it is to clean it up. So the custodian came in. He took a long-handled squeegee. He dipped it in the toilet. He cleaned the mirror, and none of the girls ever put lip prints on the mirror again. And when you think about that story, which is a true story, what you realize is that whatever kind of skill it is that that principal had, it isn't something about SATs or ACTs or GREs. It's something different. And that something different is what I'm going to be talking about tonight, namely creativity. And I'm going to argue that creativity is a decision. So I'm Provost and Senior Vice President at Oklahoma State. The talk I'm giving tonight is a collaboration of many graduate students, postdocs, and other colleagues. And although I'm giving the talk, it really represents the work of a team over a period of a number of years. So the main message is really simple. It's just one short sentence, and that is that creativity is a decision. That's it. And thank you very much. Good night. No, all right. Yeah. So that's what I'm going to be arguing tonight. So I'm going to try to show that, in large part, creativity is a decision. I'm going to review some research findings on creativity and its development. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how to apply these ideas in an educational setting. Tomorrow morning, I'll be doing a workshop where I'll talk about that in much greater detail and talk about how we're applying ideas about creativity at Oklahoma State University to transform the way we admit, instruct, and assess students. But tonight I'll just be talking more generally. So what is creativity? Nothing special. It's just the production of an idea or product that's novel, it's good or useful in some way, and it's appropriate to a task. And obviously something can be good, but not novel. So, you know, when you take a test like an SAT or an ACT, you know, it measures whether your answers are good, but, you know, creative, no, it's not about novelty. If you give a novel answer, you get it wrong. So it's good, but not novel, or an idea can be novel, but not good. There used to be a show, for those of you who are old enough, All in the Family, and it had this guy, Archie Bunker, and he had a new invention, which was a remote-controlled doorbell ringer. So what he'd do is drive up to someone's house, and he would ring the doorbell from his car, which is very comfortable, and the person would come out of the door, see no one there, get angry, slam the door, and go back. So that was a novel invention, but it wasn't good. So you need the invention or idea to be novel and good and also appropriate for some kind of task. So some people wonder, does creativity even matter? And what I would argue is that in a world that's changing as rapidly as ours is, social customs, economic situation, political situation, you name it, it's changing. Creativity is no longer a luxury. It's absolutely a necessity. And people who don't realize that are in trouble. So if you look, for example, at the Big Three versus Honda, the Big Three ran into trouble, two of them into bankruptcy, not because they were bad companies, but because they weren't innovating quickly enough. That started to change, but for many years, it was problematical. If you look at CDC versus IBM, many of you are younger, probably never heard of CDC, Control Data Corporation. Both of these companies were mainframe computer companies, but when the mainframe market started to dissipate, IBM changed to being a service company. CDC stayed a mainframe company, and they went out of business. If you're young, you've never heard of Eastern Airlines. They didn't change with the times. United and some other airlines, like Southwest, did. And when people lack creative vision, you find them saying strange things, like this telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us. That was a memo in Western Union. Or while theoretically and technically television may be feasible, commercially and financially it's an impossibility. That was an inventor. That was wrong. We don't like their sound, and guitar music is on the way out. That was Decca Recording Company rejecting the Beatles. Not a good decision. And my favorite professor at a university where I used to teach, stocks have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. Irving Fisher, professor of economics at Yale in 1929. Bad prediction. So if you don't think in creative ways, you find yourself stuck in a past that simply no longer exists. So the main idea of the talk is basically that creativity is in large part a decision, and that decision is to defy the crowd. Creative people are crowd defiers. So if everyone's walking this way, they're willing to walk that way. Because they seek to defy the crowd, by disposition, they create their own opposition. It's annoying if you're creative that you always find you have opposition, but you do, because by nature, if you're going this way and everyone else is going that way, they're not going to like you. Many reactions to famous ideas when those ideas were first disseminated were very negative, and creativity can be developed. So let's move on now. So there's a book called Rotten Reviews, and it's about this thick, and it has reviews of great works of literature when those works were first published. And you'd like to think that, like, these famous authors, when their works were first published, people must have loved them. That's generally not true. So a review of This Side of Paradise by F. Scott Fitzgerald, it seems to us, in short, that this story does not culminate in anything. The Diary of Anne Frank, the girl doesn't have a special perception or feeling which would lift that book beyond the curiosity level. Catch 22. I haven't the foggiest idea about what the man is trying to say. This constitutes a continual and unmitigated bore. Lady Chatterley's Lover, for your own good, do not publish this book. The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, you're welcome to Le Carré. He hasn't got any future. Atlas Shrugged, I regret to say the book is unsaleable and unpublishable. So in lots of cases, great works of literature, the initial reaction's very negative. And it's not just in literature. It's in everything. It's in art. One of my favorite painters is Edvard Munch, who's considered by many the greatest Norwegian painter of all time. And the very first day he exhibited in Munich, Germany, the reviews were so negative that the exhibit closed the first day, the same day it opened. Or great scientists like Copernicus and Galileo, when they first proposed their ideas, very poor reception. Galileo was branded a heretic. Even in athletics, defying the crowd can be costly. There was a ski jumping contest, and as you know, the traditional form of ski jumping was to go like this, and one of the ski jumpers went like this. And when he went like this, two things happened. One is he jumped farther than any of his competitors, and the second is he lost. And you may ask, well, how could he jump farther than any of his competitors and lose? And the answer was, he was rated down for aesthetics. If you think about it, this looks good on me, but the judges didn't think it looked good on him. And so after a while, other ski jumpers saw that he was jumping farther than they were. They started doing the same thing. So whether it's literature or art, science, athletics, music, creative ideas often meet initially with negative receptions. Basically, according to what we call an investment theory of creativity formulated with Todd Lubart, creative people buy low and sell high in the world of ideas. They're like good investors. Essentially, they're value investors. They take an idea, they come up with an idea. It's originally like a value stock. It's sort of sell. It's low. It's people don't like it. They raise the value of the stock, and then when it's high, they metaphorically sell it. Now, you may be asking yourself a perfectly reasonable question, and that is, they actually brought a guy from Oklahoma to tell us to buy low and sell high. I mean, like, geez, we already knew that, Maybe some of you did not know that and it's useful for you, but others of you may have known that. So you may be wondering, well, what's the big deal? Well, here's the deal. We all pretty much know you should buy low and sell high, but it turns out that very few people do it. So if you think about it, when the housing market was high, people were buying first homes, second homes, investment homes, other homes. When the market crashed, no one wants to buy houses, even though the prices are low and the interest rates are ridiculously low. When gold was low, you rarely saw advertisements, buy gold. Now when gold's high, you can't open a magazine with, or listen to the radio without buy gold, even though it's at a record high. So ordinary people don't buy low and sell high. Now you may think, well, that's because ordinary people are suckers. Experts do. Forbes magazine did a study, and what they did is they pinned the New York Times stock market page on the wall of their office, and then they shot darts at random at the New York Times stock market page. And what did they find? They compared the performance of the random portfolio of stocks that they got by shooting darts to the performance of professionally managed mutual funds, stock funds, over a period of a number of years. And they found that the random portfolio did better than 4 out of 5 professionally managed funds. That's pathetic. I mean, if you think how much those people are paid to manage the funds, that's really sad. So even experts generally don't buy low and sell high. Why not? Well, there are two reasons they don't, and they're pressures. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. When I was a young teenager, like 13 or so, the style for guys, if you were interested in getting girls interested in you, which I was, the style was to wear very tight pants. The tighter they were, the sexier you were considered to be. So you would wear these hip-hugging pants. I'm claustrophobic, and I just can't wear anything tight. I mean, like, you look at this. I mean, this is loose. It's not as loose as it used to be, but that's another story. In any case, so I wore loose pants. And when other guys were wearing tight pants and I was wearing loose pants, you know, they looked at me and they said, you know, Sternberg's a dork. And it's not like everyone said I was a dork. I mean, I'm not saying that. Some said I was a dweeb. So there were, you know, there was a dork contingent and a dweeb contingent. But, you know, so many people were calling me like a dork that I began to think, maybe I am a dork. I mean, maybe there really is something wrong with me. I remember thinking that because everyone else is wearing tight pants. And so what happens when you do something creative, when you defy the crowd, is first there's external pressure to conform. You better be like us. And second, you find yourself starting to put pressure on yourself because it's really uncomfortable when everyone's telling you that there's really something wrong with you. So what I would argue is that there's some key decisions creative people make. And I won't have time to go through them all in detail, but I'll talk about some of them in more detail, and then some of them I'll just sort of mention, these 13 key decisions. And the first is redefining problems. So let me explain what I mean. I once knew a woman who teaches at another university in Michigan, neither this nor that other one, and her husband was a high-level executive in one of the big 3 auto companies. And she told me that I was interested in creativity. She told me he had a problem. And she told me what they eventually did. His problem was that he really loved his job. And he made a lot of money on the job. But he hated his boss. And after years of working for a boss he just couldn't stand, he decided he had it. And he was going to get himself a new job. So he went to a headhunter. And the headhunter said, no problem, we'll get you a new job. So the guy went back and told his wife that it looks good. The headhunter said he can get me a job. And the wife at the time was teaching a course on intelligence applied, which is a book I wrote some years ago. And she was doing a unit on redefining problems, which is if you have a problem in your life and you're hitting your head against the wall and you just can't solve it, instead of hitting your head against the wall, ask yourself whether there's some other way to see the problem, whether you can essentially redefine or reformulate the problem so that you can solve the reformulated problem instead of the original one. And as they were talking about this, they realized they could apply this technique to his problem. The guy went back to the headhunter, and he gave the headhunter his boss's name. A few weeks later, the boss got a phone call offering him a job. The boss took the job. So the guy redefined the problem of having a bad boss by finding his boss another job, and that vacated the boss's job, and he got that job. So redefining problems, you know, his problem was he really couldn't stand his boss. He found his boss another job. Not suggesting you use that. A second key decision is asking yourself if you have a creative idea, asking yourself whether it's any good. And that just means asking yourself three things. If I follow this idea that I really like, what's the best that can happen? What's the worst that can happen? And what's most likely to happen? And if the best isn't that good or the worst is too bad, you just don't do it. And if you look at really bad decisions in people's personal lives, business decisions, it's usually because they didn't ask themselves what the worst that could happen is, and then it does. A third of these decisions is the realization that creative ideas don't sell themselves. You have to sell them. And you'd like to think that if you have a really creative idea, you know, that people are going to just say, wow, that's great. You're such a genius. That's not usually what happens. They usually think you're a dork or a dweeb or the equivalent. I learned this when I was very early in my career. It was my first year as an assistant professor. And the second colloquium I was invited to give was at a large testing company, again, which will remain unnamed. So I thought, this is great. You know, I'm 25 years old. It's only the second colloquium I'm invited to give. And this large testing company is already thinking of changing their tests along the lines of my ideas about intelligence. So I thought, well, I'm only 25. Imagine what I'm going to be doing when I'm 26. So I took the train. I lived near New Haven at the time. I took the train to Princeton, New Jersey. And I gave a talk, which was yet another wonderful talk. And it was clear that the audience really hated it. I mean, like, really detested it. No matter how bad you think this talk is, they thought that talk was worse. And I was really, really crestfallen. You know, I went from thinking that, what am I going to do at 26, to I hope I still have a job when I go back to New Haven. And I wondered what I did wrong. I mean, you know, like, I thought it was a pretty good talk. I thought the talk in Michigan was a good talk, too, and that didn't go over. I've had this history. If you have a few hours, maybe I could tell you. No, forget it. Okay. So anyway, so the talk didn't go over. And then I began to realize, well, did I really expect that someone who is like 65, say, is going to come up to me at 25? You know, I was 25 at the time and say, oh, I sure wasted the last 40 years doing these traditional tests. Thank God you have come. It's too bad I'm retiring next week. You know, like, this is an organization that makes skillions of dollars on traditional tests. I don't know if it's skillions or zillions, but it's a lot. And did I really think that they're going to, you know, listen to some guy who's 25 and is in his first year as an assistant professor? Of course not. And what I realized is the hardest part sometimes is not even coming up with the ideas, it's selling them. It's getting people to listen to you. And the more you defy the crowd, the harder it is to sell the ideas. But that is part of the creative process. And again, notice these are decisions. It's not like, you know, some inborn IQ or ACT or SAT score. It's something you decide to do, that if you really believe in it enough, you've got to work to sell it. A fourth of these decisions is the realization that intelligence and knowledge, essentially expertise, both help and hurt creativity. Well, it's obvious how they help. In order to go beyond what's known, you have to know what's known. And if you don't know what's known, it's hard to go beyond it. It's like, you know, the advantage I have over my students is that I know more about psychology and theory anyway. And so I'm less likely to reinvent the wheel because I know what other people did. But knowledge can also hurt. For example, earlier in my career, I was invited to give a talk in another country. I went and I gave the talk. It went pretty well. And the guy who invited me, because I'd come so far, you know, wanted to do a little tourism before I left for the United States. So he took me to the zoo in the city in which his university was. And this is a world-famous guy, very famous guy in the field of intelligence. So we went to the zoo, and when we got to the zoo, we passed the cages of the primates, and the primates were engaged in what euphemistically could be called strange and unnatural sexual behavior. I'm not going to go into details, don't worry. But when we saw them doing this stuff, he and I reacted differently. He started staring at them. And I don't know if you can tell from my accent, but I'm from a more cultured and refined kind of a background. You know, like I come from a place of breeding, New Jersey. And so I averted my eyes. And after he had been observing the primates doing the sexual stuff for several minutes, he started analyzing their sexual behavior in terms of his theory of intelligence. And I stood there thinking, well, this is really weird, because I don't know what it is that motivates the sexual behavior of primates, but I'm pretty sure it has nothing to do with his theory of intelligence or anyone's theory of intelligence. And this was like before Clinton and, you know, Spitzer and these guys who were very smart but disconnected between the intelligence part and the other stuff. And I wondered why, you know, here's this world-famous guy and he's trying to analyze sexual behavior in terms of his theory of intelligence. What's going on? And I realized that expertise can really be harmful to creativity, because you can become so entrenched and so used to seeing everything in the way you usually see it that you start to have trouble seeing things in a new way. And what I realized is that often expertise is a minus. The advantage younger people or novices have is that precisely because they know less, they're more flexible. And, you know, if you looked at my vita, you'd find that the large majority of my empirical publications are with students. And often what they contributed is the flexibility, and I contributed some of the expertise. So if you're not learning as much from your students as they're learning from you or from your kids, then you're doing something wrong, because they have something to contribute that over time you begin to lose. You need to be willing to take sensible risks. Again, a decision, not an inborn kind of ability. And I discovered this when I was in my fifth year as an assistant professor. I was coming up for tenure, and the chances are usually, you know, where I was teaching were really bad. They were 10%. But I was hearing that my case was going particularly badly. And the reason I heard it was going particularly badly was that some of the external referees who were writing letters were saying, well, why would you give tenure to a guy who studies intelligence? It's a really junky field. I mean, if you want to give a permanent position to someone, you know, look for someone who studies like reasoning or thinking or problem solving, something that's a more prestigious area of psychology. So I went to talk to a mentor, a senior faculty member, Wendell Garner, and I said to him, you know, I was really a dope. I could have done exactly the same research I'm doing, but I could have called it reasoning or problem solving or thinking, and then you wouldn't be getting external letters saying that don't give tenure to guy studies intelligence. And I said, what do you think I ought to do? And he said, well, you want my advice? I'll give you my advice. When you came here, your mission was to make a difference in the field of intelligence. That's the reason you're here. That's why you're, you know, a psychologist. And now you're afraid that doing that may cost you your job. And the truth is, you're right, it may cost you your job. But that's what you should do. I mean, that's why you're here. And if it costs you your job, you'll get another one. But if you don't do that, then there's no purpose to anything you're doing. And I realized he was right, that I had to take the risk. And that risk paid off. Some of the risks don't. But to be creative, you have to decide that you're willing to take risks. And it doesn't end when you're 30. I was 30 at the time. When I was 55, I guess I was 55, yeah, I started as a dean of arts and sciences at Tufts. I left Yale after 30 years because nothing had changed. You know, I kept trying to change the way, the whole thing about SATs and ACTs and, you know, no child left behind. Tests were becoming bigger and bigger instead of less and less. So I said, all right, maybe I need to go into an administrative job where I can really make a difference. And I said, let's change the way we do admissions. You know, like I had this theory that if you look at leaders, They're creative in coming up with a vision. They're analytical in deciding if it's a good vision. They're practical in implementing the vision and in persuading others of its value. And they're wise in ensuring that the idea helps achieve a common good over the long term as well as the short term through the infusion of positive ethical values. I said, why don't we put... I had done some research at Yale, the Rainbow Project, that showed that these things could make a difference to admissions. Why don't we actually put questions measuring these skills on the application? And I realized that if the project, this was no longer just for a journal, this was the way I was proposing we do admissions at Tufts. And now we're going to do it at Oklahoma State. And I realized if it didn't work, I was probably out of a job. But if you want to be creative, you have to be willing to take risks, whether you're 25 or 30 or 50 or 60 or 100. You need to decide that if you're going to buy low and sell high, you're willing to overcome obstacles. Because the question is not whether you will have obstacles. You will. The question is what you're going to do about it. And I learned this when I was very young. When I was a kid, I did poorly on IQ tests. I would like to think it's because I was test anxious. There may be other alternative explanations. That wasn't funny. In any case, so when I was 13 years old in seventh grade, I decided to do a project on mental testing. And I found the Stanford-Binet intelligence test in the adult section of the library in the town in which I lived in New Jersey. And as part of my project, I created my own IQ test. And as part of the project, I had this idea that I could try giving the test to some of my classmates. So, I may have had a low IQ. But there are other things I am good at, like social intelligence. You can't be a provost unless you're good at, like, social practical intelligence because you constantly have to work with people. And so I was very good at social intelligence. There was this girl I was romantically interested in, and I was kind of shy, and I needed a way to break the ice. So I used my high social intelligence. I had this idea to give her an IQ test to break the ice. So I gave her the IQ test. And if you don't learn anything else from this talk, I can guarantee you that if you want to break the ice, do not give her an IQ test. Totally doesn't work. Anyway, so that was a bomb. And then I knew this guy from Cub Scouts. And, I mean, the girl I'm over, you know, it's like I don't even remember her name. It was Sandy. So that's something I'm totally over, and I don't even, you know, remember the event. You know, the girl in seventh grade that I gave the IQ test to. So anyway, there was this other guy beside the girl in seventh grade I gave the IQ test to. There was this guy I knew from Cub Scouts, and I thought, well, he's safe. So I give him the test, and it turned out I was wrong again. I mean, I wasn't such a good judge of character after all. Because unbeknownst to me, the guy had a mental illness. And I realized this is a very sophisticated audience. I know that, so I'm going to use the technical term in DSM-4 and same in DSM-5. The guy is what is called a tattletale. When I gave him the test, he tattled to his mother that I'd give him the test. And it turns out, I don't know if you know this, that being a tattletale is genetic. Because she then told the junior high school guidance counselor. And it further turns out that it's contagious because then she told the head school system psychologist. And the guy came to my school and bawled me out for like 50 minutes, ending with, if I ever brought the test into school again, he personally would burn it. He did suggest I should study intelligence in rats, although I don't think he was offering himself as a subject. But, you know, when he forbade me to bring the test into school again, I mean, like, this guy claimed to be a psychologist. If you don't want a kid to do something, what is the absolute dumbest thing you can do? Tell him not to do it, right? I mean, like, that made it really exciting. And so I'm still studying intelligence. It's not like I'm trying to get even with the guy. I mean, like, you know, that's not part of my makeup. I hope he knows about this. Anyway, so you have to be willing to overcome obstacles. And you have to find what you love to do. People who are creative are doing things that they really love. That's just a general research finding. I have two kids from my first marriage, and I also have 10-month-old triplets, so I have five kids. But when my son from my first marriage was young, he played the piano. And I was very happy he played the piano. I played the piano. I liked the piano. I liked that he was playing the piano. And then he quit. And when he quit, I was very disappointed. And then after a few months, he announced that he wanted to play the trumpet. And I said to him, Seth, you just quit the piano. We're not going to get you a trumpet like you're a quitter. And after I said that, I realized that's a terrible thing to say to a kid. I hope you never say that to a child. And I realized that was horrible, and I tried to figure out, why did I say that? And I realized that the reason was that I don't like the trumpet. If your kids want to play the trumpet, you know, fine, but I couldn't imagine a Sternberg kid playing the trumpet. Just didn't fit my image of Seth. And I realized that's a very stupid thing to think, because you'll never encourage a kid to be creative if you want them to be just like you. They have to be just like them. So I said to Seth, you know, Seth, and he was young, I said, Seth, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. We're going to get you a trumpet. We got him the trumpet, and guess what? He quit. He was a quitter. I was right. But that's not exactly the point of the story. The point of the story is that it's really hard to find what kids like. But if you want them to be creative, if you want to be creative, you just have to keep trying till you find the thing you really love to do. So there are other things. I don't have time to go into them in detail. You have to continue to grow. You know, decide that you're not going to just stop with whatever you did when you were 15 or 20, that you'll keep doing new things, that you'll keep developing rather than letting yourself get stuck. You have to believe in yourself, that you, even when people are telling you you're crazy, that you can do creative work. You need to be willing to tolerate ambiguity. Sometimes when you're doing creative work, it doesn't all fall into place at once. You have to sometimes just keep going, even when things are looking pretty bleak. You have to take yourself and your ideas somewhat lightly. What I found when I was an assistant professor and I looked at all those senior people who were taking up the tenure slots that I deserved, you know, the dead wood, and I realized that the people who became dead wood, which now people are no doubt saying about me, those people were people who were sure they were right. They really took their ideas seriously. And the problem with taking your ideas really, really seriously is then you never move beyond those ideas because you're sure you're right. So you have to realize that what you do, that you never reach, unless you're God, you never reach final answers. And you have to seek an environment that encourages and rewards creativity. And realize that creativity is a way of life. It's not just something you do in an art class. It's something you do every day in your personal relationships, in your business, in your transactions with other people. It's a decision you make. So if you want to teach people for creative thinking, I teach a course on leadership. I've taught introductory psychology. I've taught many different courses. What you do is you have kids create things, design things, invent, imagine, suppose. It's teaching them a way of thinking, not just memorizing, of course, but getting to do new things, like create a poem or a sculpture or a game or design a new system of government for the classroom or design a scientific investigation or design a comfortable home or invent a new means of transportation, a new life form, or imagine what life would be like in another country or what it would be like to be president or how do bees communicate with each other, or suppose worldwide temperatures keep increasing, or suppose people were paid to inform on neighbors. I mean, it's what I do in my class. You know, I'll ask them to design an experiment, to create a theory of leadership. I ask them to apply the theories they learn to their own leadership and say how they can change what they do. But it's really just creating a way of thinking in your kids so that they invent, create, imagine, suppose, rather than just memorizing what you tell them. And you can assess creative thinking. So one of the tasks was used is draw the earth from an insect's point of view. And that was one of the drawings we got. It's a reasonable drawing. You know, it's good. It's not hugely novel. But it shows, you know, earth from an insect's point of view. You see the foot. And this was a more creative one. It shows the facets of an insect's eye. And each facet shows a different threat, a can of Raid, a bird, an angry man, a net, a swatter. So in terms of quality, they're both good drawings, but this one is more novel. It's more creative. Or you could ask, how could you tell if there were space aliens hiding among us? Which is, you know, think about it. I mean, not so implausible. A less creative response would be to test their knowledge of countries on the earth to see if they know what the names of the major countries are. A more creative response would be to test their knowledge of television shows and movies that Earth children would have been likely to see. The problem with the first response is that alien spy school teaches you the names of the countries, so you know that stuff, but they don't teach you what were the things that you would have seen as a child. And it turns out, you know, some of you may think, well, this is really far out, you know, like, where's this guy's head on cloud nine? But this is an article in a very prestigious newspaper, the National Enquirer. Space aliens, say experts. Here's how you can tell. It's by a well-known extraterrestriologist, Michael Cassells. And the things you look, there are things you can look for if you suspect someone's a space alien. Odd or mismatched clothes, strange diet, unusual eating habits, a bizarre sense of humor. you know, they show strange reactions when they're near high-tech hardware. So there are things you can look for. And, you know, I mean, this is a problem. You've probably noticed it before. They did a scientific investigation. They asked the senators if they're space aliens. 12 of them said yes. They admitted it. Another thing would be, what would the world be like today if some major event in history had come out differently? This is a question we used at Tufts University. This is one of the ones we used on our mission application. And here are a couple essays that we actually got. If the Trojans had heeded Laocoon's advice and thrown Odysseus's wooden horse into the sea, they would have defeated the Greeks at Troy. Aeneas would then never have had reason to flee the city, and he would never have ventured to Italy to found Rome. Without Rome, neither the Roman Republic nor a Roman Empire would have existed. Concrete, the arch, plumbing, and the sauna might never have been invented. The modern implications of Rome never having existed are indeed drastic. Lacking even concrete floors, people would resort to sleeping in the mud, and without plumbing or saunas, they would be perpetually filthy and generally quite chilly. France would not have built the base of the Eiffel Tower without arches, so tourists would be unable to purchase miniature collectible towers in Parisian convenience stores. So that's a creative essay. It's novel. It's good. Here's another one. This is a perfectly good essay. It's at least as well written as the first one. If ETS or ACT were scoring, it might even get higher grades. What if the ramification of the 19th Amendment did not pass and women were never given the right to vote? What would life for women like me be like in the United States? For one thing, I probably would not be writing this essay. If women were not given the right to vote, I probably would stop going to school after this year. It would be unlikely that I would receive a college education. Without suffrage, my career options would be limited, if a career were a possibility at all. My accepted practices would be limited to staying home and taking care of the family. Rather than being equals, women would be subservient to men. I might not drive, I might not dress in the way in which I choose to, and I might not live my life the way I choose to, and I can in the 21st century. Perfectly good essay. You know, in terms of analytical skill, expository skill, just as good or better than the first, just not as creative. So this stuff works. At Yale, we did a project among about 1,000 students across the country. We found that using creative measures, we could double prediction of first-year undergraduate grades and reduce ethnic group differences by half. At Tufts, in the Kaleidoscope project, we found that measuring creativity on a university application, we eliminated ethnic group differences, we improved prediction of first-year grades, and we improved prediction of extracurricular and leadership activities. We're doing a new project at Oklahoma State called Panorama, which will be university-wide for undergraduate admissions. We don't have data yet, but we'll be, again, looking for creative as well as analytical, practical, and wise thinking. And then we have a project for younger kids, same thing. So let me sum it up. There's a story, it's not my story, it's by Isaac Asimov, it's called The End of Eternity. And in this story, there's a paradox. And the paradox is this, that in the distant future, there's time travel. And time travel is completely interwoven into the fabric of society. So people go back and forth in time. And they realize that there's a paradox, and that is that everyone knows that the equations for time travel were formulated in the 24th century by a great mathematician. But everyone also knows that he couldn't have done it, because in the 24th century, the math had not yet been formulated that would have enabled him to come up with the equations for time travel. Thus, he did it, but he couldn't have done it. And that's a paradox. Now, the reason it's troubling in the 80th century, say, is that if he didn't do it, then all of the future history couldn't exist because their existence depends on time travel. But it does exist, so he must have done it. But since he couldn't have done it, there's a paradox and their existence could be snuffed out at any time. So they realize that the only way they can resolve the paradox, at least that they can think of, is they have to send someone back from the 80th century to the 24th century to teach the mathematician the math he would need to formulate the equations for time travel so that he can announce the equations. And that way, in the future, those equations will allow them to send back someone to the 24th century. They have to complete the loop. You get it? If not, do it as a homework assignment. In any case, so they choose a guy who's nothing special named Cooper, and he's going to go back to teach the great mathematician the math. He doesn't have to be anything great because all he has to do is give the guy the mathematical equations and then get lost. So he's like a messenger. He's like a postman. He doesn't have to be anything special. So they send him back, and then because it's a novel and, you know, you need enough pages to sell a novel, things start to go wrong. Three things go wrong. The first thing that goes wrong is it turns out that Cooper is a hermit. No one knows what he looks like or where he lives. But Cooper finally finds him. He's a hermit on a mountaintop, and he finds him at the mountaintop. The second thing that goes wrong is that it turns out the hermit, the mathematician, is a jerk. And when Cooper tries to give him the math, he almost shoots him. But Cooper manages to insinuate himself into the company of the mathematician, and so he solves the second problem. So now he's done. He's given the mathematician the math he needs, and now he can leave, except then the third thing goes wrong. The third thing that goes wrong is that one day the mathematician is out hiking on the mountaintop. He falls down. He hits his head, and he dies. So now he's dead. And the bad thing about being dead, there are a lot of bad things about being dead, but the bad thing from the standpoint of the equations for time travel is he no longer can formulate them because he's now deceased. And that means that in 6 weeks, when the equations are supposed to be announced to the world, the guy won't be there to announce them because he's dead. So Cooper is very depressed because now, as soon as that time comes, future history will change and everyone would have existed will be snuffed out. That's a big responsibility. And then he realizes he can redefine the problem. He decides he's got to somehow use the math to formulate equations for time travel, but he's no great mathematician. And so what he does is he works really hard. He analyzes his work. He doesn't know that much, so he's flexible. He takes a risk. He does everything I talked about tonight. And just in the nick of time, he formulates the equations for time travel. So what he does is he goes from the mountain. He calls a press conference. He announces to the world that he has formulated the equations for time travel. And he says his name. And he gives us his name, the name of the great mathematician. And since no one knew what the mathematician looked like, they believe them. And now it can go down in the history books that the great mathematician formulated the equations for time travel. Everything's fine, except for one thing. It's a fraud. Cooper feels badly because he committed a fraud. It was not the great mathematician who did it. It's he who did it. And then he has one last realization. The last realization is it was never going to be the great mathematician who did it. It was always going to be him. That great mathematician was always going to die after he fell and hit his head. From the standpoint of history, he was the great mathematician. He decided for creativity, and that's what enabled him to do it. And you can make that decision too. Thank you very much for listening.
No cards?
Interesting. Well, we had a little plan to use cards, but I think that there are no cards. So we're going to get creative and see if we can't have a question-answer session without cards and without moderating the cards. So I think what we'll do is we'll just open it up. And since I've got this mic here and you don't have one, we can try to get the questions. And if people can't hear, I'll repeat them. Is that right? No cards. Too funny. Okay. So does somebody have a question they'd like to start with?
Yes. Go ahead.
So you said that intelligence can actually be detrimental to
What is the evidence for it? The question was, what is the evidence that intelligence can be detrimental to creativity? When people have looked at the relation between IQ and creative performance, it's linear up to a certain point, and then there's a slight dip. So if you look at people, for example, who try to be creative leaders, the people who are really high on the scale have trouble. Why? The reason some people think, at least that I think, is that an important part of creativity is, an important part of creativity is the persuasion part. It's communicating with people. And when you get people who are very smart, they often after a certain point, they have trouble communicating with people who are not as lofty as they are. So as you get to you can think of really intellectual politicians. If they don't communicate well, often they're not able to sell their creative ideas. That's number one. So that's one of the reasons I think there's a dip. The second reason I think that, and not everyone agrees with me. You know, I defy the crowd. There are many people who would disagree with this, especially people who do well on IQ tests. Second thing, what I have argued is that I think our schools are making a really horrible mistake. And the horrible mistake, if you teach students, you'll know what I'm talking about. The horrible mistake is if you very heavily reward kids who are great at memory and analytical skills. I'll give you an example. I had a student who applied to the graduate program at Yale when I was director of graduate studies. I'll call her Alice. And she had great grades, great test scores. She had like 800s on the GREs, really top of the line. Great recommendations. We accepted her. She was really good the first year. The GRE successfully predicted her first year performance. When it came time to do a dissertation, by the time she did her dissertation, she went from being one of the top students to being one of the bottom students. And what happened was very simple. She was really good at doing memory and analytical stuff. She just wasn't very creative. Why? Well, think about it. The reinforcement system of the schools is very much, if you're a good test taker, you're very heavily rewarded for developing memory and analytical skills. You have no incentive at all to develop other skills because those are not being rewarded. You know, it's your test scores that are getting you into gifted programs and great tracks and great universities. And so what happens is you don't develop the other skills even though you could have. In contrast, to another student I call Barbara, and her test scores were terrible. She had published work as an undergraduate. She had great recommendations. She was rejected. I was the only person who voted for her. And I hired her as a research associate. And she was terrific. She was just as creative as, you know, I thought she would be. And 2 years later, she was accepted as the top pick into our graduate program. But the problem is that she was great in the graduate program. For every Barbara who gets a chance in the face of really low test scores, there are 1,000 or 10,000 who don't even get a chance. So I think a lot of it is the socialization system. There's another kind of thing. If you're an administrator, you know what I'm talking about. So when you go around raising money, you know, if any of you are in administration, just look at the people you're talking to. Almost none of them were the people who had 4.0 averages and really high ACTs and SATs. They're mostly people who didn't score so well on the tests, and they became entrepreneurs, or they went into business, and they really made a lot of money, doing creative things in the practical domain. In our own research, we have found that on the kinds of tests of creativity I'm talking about, the data are published. You know, I can give you our data. They've been published in a number of journals. But what we find is that factor analytically, you can separate out a creative factor from an analytical factor. They're not totally independent, but the correlation is very small. They're really measuring different kinds of things. But, you know, from my point of view, the whole no child left behind society is making a horrible mistake because they're developing skills that aren't going to matter very much when people go out into the real world. And so we're going to end up with a bunch of people who... And we do that. You know, what we've done is we've created a system of social stratification where people, you know, who are really good on these tests get jobs at great places like Lehman Brothers, you know, and come up with very fancy formulas, and their businesses fail. From my point of view, in a way, we did better when we had C students become bankers because they get disconnected from the real world. That's not because there's some intrinsic negative correlation between analytical and creative skills. It's a reward system that funnels you to think in certain ways that creates that kind of correlation.
Can you give an example of some of the questions you give to measure creativity?
Sure.
Yeah,
the question was, could I give an example of some of the kinds of questions you use to measure creativity? Some of them I did. For example, suppose Rosa Parks had given up her seat on the bus, or suppose the Nazis had won World War II. Imagine some kind of future event, and suppose it had come out differently. What would the world be like today? The one about, another one was, we'll give you a short story, like, a title, it might be The End of MTV or Confessions of a Middle School Bully. And you'll get about a dozen titles. Pick one or two of those and write a creative story. Or another one is we'll show you a pictorial collage like of some musicians or athletes and you have to tell a story about it. Another one was draw the Earth from an insect's point of view. On the Tufts application, another thing we did is we asked them to draw a design for a new product or an advertisement for a new product. Or we asked them to do a creative YouTube video and give us the web address. So we use lots of different things to measure creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The question was how does the theory of multiple intelligences relate to my work? I assume you're referring to Gardner's theory. So some of you won't know what that is. What Gardner has claimed is that there are 8 multiple intelligences that are relatively independent of each other: linguistic, logical, mathematical, spatial, musical, kinesthetic, interpersonal, intrapersonal, and naturalistic. So that's what he's claimed. And the way it relates to the kind of stuff I do is that in my theory of intelligence, I argue that people need creative skills to come up with ideas, analytical skills to know if they're good ideas, practical skills to implement the ideas and to persuade others of the value, and wisdom to ensure they're for a common good. So let's take the linguistic domain. So you could do creative work in the linguistic domain, like write a poem. You could do analytical work in the linguistic domain, write a book review, an analysis of a book. You could do practical work in the linguistic domain, like in debating or arguing for position. So you can cross these processes with the domains of Gardner's theory. Yeah.
How might we bring them and not treat them?
Well, in answer to your first question, yes. I think that Jobs and Gates are good examples of people who decided for creativity.
Well,
that's certainly not inconsistent with what I've been saying. I think there could be universities where they did well, but universities sometimes... other universities than this tend to be more confining. In response to your second question, so what I did, when I went to Oklahoma State, I said that, I really wanted to go to a land-grant institution. That was my goal. And when I went for my interview, I said, from my point of view, the purpose of a college education is to produce leaders who will make a positive, meaningful, and enduring difference to the world. To make the world a better place to live. That's it. One sentence. If you like that, hire me. If you don't like that, I'm the wrong guy. Then when I said, how do you do that? Well, the first thing is with regard to admissions. You want to admit people who have creative, analytical practical and wisdom-based skills. So I spent my first year, as I did my first year at Tufts, you can't just go and implement something because if, you know, if the provost has an idea, how good really could it be? So I spent the first year talking to people about how Panorama, this idea, fit the land-grant mission. That, you know, just admitting people on the ACT, ACTs don't predict who are going to be great leaders, who are going to make the world a better place. I mean, does anyone really think they do? That's not to say that ACTs or SATs are, don't matter, because they measure analytical skills, which are actually part of the, you know, augmented theory of successful intelligence. So analytical skills matter, but ACTs and SATs don't measure the creative part, they don't measure the practical part, they don't measure the wisdom part. They do measure the analytical part. So let's expand their admissions to take into account these different things. Then I said, if you admit kids who have these different kinds of skills, if you agree with me that we want to admit kids for leadership, because that's really what the purpose of a university education is, to produce active citizens and leaders who will make the world a better place, then you have to teach them in ways that correspond to the way they learn. And kids learn in different ways. So, like, when I took introductory psychology, I got a C. And my professor said to me, you know, the first score I got was 3 out of 10. That was the very first grade I received in college. And the professor said, you know, there's a famous term in psychology, and it's obvious there won't be another one. So that was discouraging. And, you know, I said, well, geez, you know, if you have someone like me who's a creative learner in a memory class, that's not going to go well. My daughter, Sarah, is an analytical learner. You know, she went to law school, and now she's getting a PhD. She went to Yale Law School, and now she's going to Harvard, and she'll be a professor. And my son, Seth, is a practical learner. He dropped out of business school, and now he's a CEO and owns his own plane. I mean, you know, so they have different patterns of learning. And if you don't teach to the kids who are not the memory learners, you're going to be sorry when you go to fundraise for them because they're not going to give you any money. So, you know, who's going to get the last laugh here? So we started a center called the Lasso Center. We're putting about $1 million a year into it. And it's to increase our retention rate, but it has other purposes as well. It's to help them make up for academic skills where they may be deficient, or tacit knowledge skills where they don't learn, they don't know the ropes, or to help them believe in themselves that they can succeed, or to teach them self-regulation skills. And so many students are using the Lasso Center because they are the tutors who are individually mentoring them in the ways they learn. I also reorganized something called the Institute for Teaching and Learning Excellence, which had been doing something else, which I didn't think was really so helpful to the students. And the emphasis now is on teaching teachers how to teach to the way kids learn, because I would argue if the kids aren't learning, you're not really teaching. You may feel like you're teaching, but you're not really teaching. So the idea of ITLE is to teach teachers how to teach to the way kids learn, so that the kids can better stay in college and become the leaders they have the potential to be. So I think anyone at any age can start changing what they do. And, you know, I'm constantly changing what I do. I mean, I was never a provost before. I'm 103, and, you know, it's been fun. Yeah. I don't see our views as incompatible at all. In our research, when we have measured creativity in different domains, we find that it's, as other people have, that it's relatively domain-specific. But I think that's partly because when you find a domain that you're excited about, you spend more time and energy and effort into it, and that gives you the expertise that enables you to go further and sort of make a contribution. So I think there is always, it's very important to find a match between who you are and what you do. In my own case, just to give you an example, in a very different domain, you know, I spent 30 years at Yale. It was great. But I reached a point in my life where it was no longer a match. And I went to Tufts, and I spent 5 years there. And then I really wanted to go to a land-grant institution because I wanted to be in a place that was a match to where I thought the kind of creativity I have really would be a fit, and people would appreciate in a land-grant this idea of developing leadership. So I basically agree with Feldman. He tends more to emphasize like prodigies and people who are kind of extremely big C creative, as we call them. My view is that anyone can be creative, and if we're not creative, we pay for it in lost jobs, in lost personal relationships, and in lost ability to have a satisfying life.
What I do
is we have a whole training protocol for teaching raters how to rate. So we have what are called rubrics. So, for example, for creativity, we look for novelty, quality, task appropriateness. For analytical, we look for how logical, organized, balanced the response is. For practical, we look at feasibility with respect to time, place, human, material, resources, and persuasiveness. So we have a protocol. We train them. First, we have them work together as a group. Then we have them go work in small groups. Then we have them work individually and come back in the group. For the most part, we find that we can get, like a Amabile, we can get an inter-rater reliability of about 0.8, which is pretty good. It's not as reliable as a test like the SAT or the ACT, but I think what we've done is we've sacrificed validity, broad spectrum validity for tests that are very narrow in what they measure, but the what I call pseudo-quantitative precision, that if we can get a number, it must be really good. So we can get pretty good inter-rater reliability, but there's a constraint on that, and that is that if the raters are not themselves reasonably creative, it can be a problem. We did, one of the studies I did with Todd Lubart, we looked at the relation between risk-taking, your propensity to risk-taking, and your creative performance in two domains, an artistic domain and a verbal domain. And in the artistic domain, we got a strong relationship. In the verbal domain, we didn't. So that was too bad because then you can't publish the study, and if you can't publish the study, it doesn't go on your vita. If it doesn't go on your vita, you don't get promoted. If you don't get promoted, you get fired. You know, your life is a mess. So we decided to look more carefully at the individual responses, and what we found is that some of the raters were rating down responses that they felt violated social norms. So it's really important to train the raters and have raters who believe in these concepts of creativity. Can you teach creativity, or is it, what was the second part? Or is it in the person? Well, on this view that creativity is a decision, it's something very much you can teach. And the way you teach it is by encouraging kids to do things in your classwork that have them imagine, discover, create, invent, explore, suppose, things like that. So I literally use those prompts in activities in my classes. So, for example, in my intro class, intro psych class, I might say, imagine we gave the Wechsler Intelligence Scale for children to kids in rural Kenya. Do you think they do as well as kids, say, growing up in East Lansing on average? And they'll probably say no, which is correct. We've done that study. Well, why wouldn't they do as well? And it's to get them to think about, well, what's different there from what they're used to here. And then if you say, well, if they wouldn't do as well, how about kids in inner city Detroit? Would they do as well? Or maybe the adaptive skills they need are different and they're good at a different set. This is not just hypothetical. We've done these studies. We did a study in, among Eskimo kids. And if you give them tests of their adaptive skills in hunting, fishing, gathering, the kinds of things they do in their everyday lives, they do better than the kids who are in the urban setting. But if they're given an IQ test, the kids in the urban setting do better than the Yupik Eskimo kids. In Kenya, we did a study where we gave kids, we found that there are kids who would know the names of 80 or 90 or 100 natural herbal medicines that could be used to combat parasitic illnesses. And what we found is that, you know, well, how many of these medicines do your kids know? None. Why? Because they don't need to know them. Well, then why don't those kids know some of the stuff that's on the IQ test? Because they have not needed that in the course of their adaptation to their lives. So, in fact, we found in the rural Kenya study that there was a negative correlation between scores on the practical adaptive intelligence test and an IQ test, because the kids who had the practical adaptive skills, upon getting an apprenticeship, dropped out of school because they didn't need school anymore. They, you know, to make a living, they needed an apprenticeship, and the kids who were losers who couldn't get apprenticeships stayed in school. So a lot of these correlations are not intrinsic in the person. They're societally created by the kinds of person-environment interactions that you encounter. I don't think on average it is great for developing creativity, and it's getting worse and worse. The more emphasis we put on standardized tests, you know, standardized tests, schools are essentially teaching to the tests now. They've pretty much stopped educating kids and they're teaching to tests, and that doesn't tend to foment creative thinking. I'm not against tests. You know, I wouldn't even, you know, I'm not even trying to convince Oklahoma State to drop the ACT or the SAT. I think that they're useful in a limited way. The problem is that when it would be like trying, you know, when we judge people on just one thing, it would be like if you're thinking of marrying someone, would you judge them on just one thing, like how tall they are or how much money they make or, you know, how much you like their jokes? That's what we're doing in schools. We're just taking one narrow thing and we're judging people as though that tells us a whole lot about the person, when in fact it doesn't. So I think schools in this country are on the wrong path. And honestly, I thought under Obama it would change, but it's not changed. It's more of the same. The question was, do you see creativity as coming more from the right brain or the left? That distinction turned out to be somewhat oversimplified. That was a distinction that was popular at one time in neuropsychological research, but is no longer very popular because the two parts of the brain interact a lot. So in terms of the sort of traditional conception, you might say, well, it's more a right brain thing. But it's like in my theory of intelligence, these things are constantly interacting because you have to come up with new ideas, but then you have to ask yourself whether they're good ideas, and then you have to revise the idea to make it a better idea. So I think that those kinds of simplifications were more of a metaphor. Than there are people in here from psychology who know much more about the brain than I do, but I think that the metaphor was pretty much oversimplified.
Okay. I think with that we'll close, but I'd like to remind you all that tomorrow from 11:30 to 1, there's a workshop in C204 of Snyder Hall, which is in the Residential College for the Arts and Humanities, that's open to the public, and it will be really a real workshop, so there's going to be dialogue and discussion, and we'd like to thank you all for coming and thank Dr. Sternberg for his talk.
Thank you. I'll look forward to seeing you all in 2047.